Givenchy dress. I'm so possessive, so I rock his rock necklaces.
We're about to have a conversation with Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, best-selling author, activist, writes a weekly column for the Truth Dig. His latest books, Unspeakable with David Talbot and Wages of Rebellion, wrote a new piece in Truth Dig, came out on February the 5th, called Make America Ungovernable. And Chris Hedges, welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark.
So this is, let me just start here. This is a really fascinating piece you wrote. And I read it and been debating, discussing it with one of my producers this morning, on and off. And you write this with a sense of urgency. Well, let me take two things. A, you write it with a sense of urgency. And B, you really see the Trump administration as a kind of rising authoritarian network. But let's start with why you see this as stage with such urgency.
Because the democratic institutions that are tasked with defending the rights of citizens, but even more importantly, determining what is true and just, have been so corroded over the last three or four decades under corporate assault that they have lost their credibility. That includes the press, that includes the university system, and that includes the courts. And so you can have, as we have recently, a poll out saying that despite the plethora of lies that spew out of the White House, the Trump administration, in the eyes of much of the public, has more credibility than the press. And the Trump, or especially Bannon and the figures around him, have made the press, the university system, and the courts targets for that reason. So I think that it's clear where they're going. The question is whether they can get there. I am worried about a kind of complacency among people who understand Trump and Bannon and who believe that the deep state, the established systems of power, will purge them from the White House. I'm not convinced that's going to happen. That's why.
So there has been, between what happened at the airports over immigration, the millions and millions of people who poured out across America and across the globe on the Women's March, the consistent kind of outcry you're seeing from below, and black, brown, and all communities across America. I mean, it's not as there's also an awakening. Seems to me,
without question, but there's two problems with it. One, it's an awakening without a clear political vision. It's just an anti-Trump awakening. And there needs to be something more than that. It also is localized. And we have to fight this on a national level. Now, as Francine Prose and now others have called for this nationwide strike on the 17th, I certainly hope that happens. But every day they are consolidating power to a greater degree, purging the government to the greater degree, whether that's at the State Department. We will now watch Betsy DeVos do this as they begin the campaign to defund public education. Sessions is now the Attorney General. Yes, and I think the awakening is great, but I think my fear is that we need to recognize the forces we are up against and the fact that the systems of internal security, the police, Homeland Security, the FBI, and remember, they have the tools of wholesale surveillance. There's a great deal of sympathy for the Trump administration, especially within the military and the police. So I'm not Nostradamus. I don't know where the future's going, but I've seen these types of figures rise to power before in places like Yugoslavia, which I covered for the New York Times, including this kind of buffoonish quality that many of these demagogues have, whether that was Franjo Tuđman in Croatia or Radovan Karadžić in Bosnia or Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia. So I think it's better to err on the side of caution, because the forces that are collected around Trump are deeply and blatantly anti-democratic. And our democracy itself is so anemic that that we're in danger.
I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, there was a report this morning, a couple of things that happened today, just that maybe after I read your article that I read them, the Trump is calling for greater police activity, that he wants to see the government fund. He's talking about there was an interesting article in the today by an op-ed by an American University professor talking about ordinary Americans carried out inhumane acts for Trump, about all these people who worked for federal government at airports, what they did to people, how they abused them coming through the airports, old people, young people, handcuffing five-year-olds. So there's clearly a move afoot on his part. And then you see, you know, Sessions and AG, what's happening at the Environmental Protection Agency, DeVos at Education, and more. So given the way this country moves, some people might argue that this cannot happen with real rapidity. This will not happen overnight, that it takes time to organize against it, and maybe you have the time to do that.
Well, the problem is that we don't have the kind of movements that can respond. You had enthusiasm and even money pour into the Bernie Sanders campaign, and it advertised itself as a movement, but it wasn't. It was an electoral campaign, and once Sanders conceded to Hillary Clinton, the movement dissipated, and he attempted to funnel whatever energy and money was left into the campaign of Hillary Clinton, which I fault him for. I did not support Sanders because of that, because we do need to build movements which are going to have to wander in the political wilderness for a little while. And we don't have those movements. And you're right. It's hard to build those movements quickly. We can create through social media kind of flash mobs, even of significant size, as we saw in the Women's March in Washington. But that's not a movement. And unless we build, and I think movements often are kind of generated out of localities, is the way the civil rights movement was generated out of Montgomery, Alabama. I think we're very weak, and that again is one of the reasons for my deep concern, is that in many ways we're defenseless against this assault.
So, from your perspective, how is that movement created? I mean, when you look back in the 1960s, you said Montgomery, Alabama. I mean, there was the student SCLC, the Student Christian Leadership Conference, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, pardon me, around Martin Luther King and Andrew Young and those, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, CORE, that were kind of the heart, different hearts of the civil rights movement moving through the South, one more militant than the next. You had white movements coming out of that movement in the North with students that kind of spread across the country. But they were pretty small, but had an effect.
Right, but they were coupled with other movements, the anti-war movement, the environmental movement, Earth First, Earth Day, the first Earth Day, the women's movement. There were a series of eruptions within American society that eventually created coalitions, certainly around the issue of civil rights. And we don't have that. And what has been happening over the last four decades is that the ruling establishment, in particular the business interests, reacted with great fear over the opening of democratic space in the 1960s. And it is over the last four decades, you can read the 1971 Lewis Powell memo, which kind of lays out the blueprint for this.
Right.
They've used corporate money to carry out what John Ralston Saul correctly calls a kind of corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. So Trump is the product of a failed system. Trump is the product of a democracy that seized up and was captured by a cabal, in this case, corporatists rather than communists or fascists or monarchists. And they used all of the levers of power to serve the interests of that corporate cabal at our expense, creating political paralysis, which vomited up the figure like Trump. And this is what happens when democratic systems break down. As Richard Rorty pointed out in his last book, Achieving Our Country, this is dangerous because it not only discredits a liberal democracy, which continues to speak in the language of liberalism and democracy, but it discredits the very idea of a liberal democracy. So you have in the Trump insurgency not only an assault against liberal institutions, I'm using it with a small L, liberal democratic institutions, but also liberal democratic values. That's what we're seeing, and that's potentially, especially if we undergo some kind of a crisis, economic or domestic terrorism, can just see what's left vanish. I mean, we can just become a very kind of naked authoritarian police state instantly.
One of the greatest, what you pointed out here, I think, is one of the great dangers. If there was some internal attack from whatever quarter that came from, that would be extremely dangerous in terms of what their response could be. I mean, when you write here that Trump's regime's demented project of social engineering, which will become wrapped in a Christianized fascism, can be implemented only if it quickly seizes control of bureaucratic mechanisms. And you throw that out there on top of that saying in the next paragraph, the number of governorships and state legislators where they hold both chambers, they can totally reorder the Constitution, even if they continue to abide by it, which they may not. We are facing a serious crisis. Let's take those two statements.
So I'm quoting the great organizer Cal Iacuno out of Jackson, Mississippi.
Correct.
Part, yeah.
Correct. So talk a bit about blend those ideas there. I mean, what do you foresee could happen with that? You're not saying it is going to happen, but you're foreseeing the possibility of something happening.
Well, Robert Paxton, in his study of fascism, in his book Anatomy of Fascism, argues that all of these movements need a crisis, either one that they happen to confront or one they even manufacture. The famous case of the Reichstag fire, which allowed the Nazis to declare martial law in order to consolidate power totally. And that's what worries me, because, as you correctly pointed out, we don't have the movements, and it takes a lot of time to build movements. So we actually have at this moment a diminishing space where we as dissidents can work and have our voices heard, although you also see an attempt by the forces of the deep state to discredit critics, especially critics of capitalism. That's what this Washington Post article based on this shadowy website Proper Not did. It listed 200 groups, and we were on it. Truthdig was on it. Black Agenda Report was on it. And when the lawyers from Truthdig called the Washington Post, they said, well, we don't know who these people are. And the Post said, the lawyers said, well, we know who they are, but we're not going to tell you, but you can appeal to them to get your name off. Well, that's exactly how McCarthyism works. And all of these things, which have really been all of these mechanisms to shut down civil liberties, which have been put into place by George W. Bush and Barack Obama, including the Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which I sued him in federal court over, which overturns the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which had prohibited the military from being used as a domestic police force. That's all gone. So the military can go out into the streets and carry out acts, in essence, of extraordinary rendition, seize U.S. citizens, hold them in military facilities indefinitely without due process. And when we won in the Southern District Court of New York, Judge Catherine Forrest, correctly, in her opinion, said, this opens the way for the government to criminalize an entire group or category of people. And she brought up the plight of the 110,000 Japanese-Americans who were interned by the U.S. government in World War II. So the corporate state has already built the edifice of repression that they have now put into the hands of Steve Bannon and Trump and those around them. And it's a kind of creeping process where you are discrediting the press as an opposition party, so-called judge, et cetera, et cetera. But in a moment of crisis, in the name of national security, they can instantly implement their agenda. And let's not forget that this agenda has been conceived, written, by lobbyists, the Koch brothers and others, it's all ready to go. I think that Trump himself has no personal ideology, which is why I expect that his ideology or the vacuum of that ideology will be filled by the radical Christian right.
Bannon and the others.
Yeah, Bannon has no – Bannon, somebody called him a Twitter fascist. I mean, Bannon has no real following. He considers himself the sort of reactionary version of Lenin's vanguard and these second-rate pseudo-intellectuals who have college degrees from Yale or somewhere.
So, looking at this from in a couple of ways, I mean, when we talk about a movement piece, I want to talk about what's about nonviolence and what this large movement means to you. But starting with the movement piece for a moment, that what you're seeing around the country happening right here in Baltimore, we're broadcasting from, there are people, whether it's the people who created Indivisible, or it's the groups that are more to the left, they're now be involving themselves in the Indivisible. The millions of people who marched on the Women's March that day that was really spearheaded by many women of color after the original dissension over how it was originally organized, but it grew and built, and there was a unity there that people didn't expect to happen, but did happen. So, I mean, but to me, that is when you're watching these things happen around the country. Unite here, unions here, trying to figure out how to begin to organize workers on the lower level in communities all across the country, I mean low-wage workers, to respond to this. To me, that is a movement. That's how a movement builds. That's where it comes from. I mean, that is how it erupts, and that's where the formation comes from.
I don't think – and I'm not against the marching. I went down to Washington and was part of the demonstration. I was in the marches on Trump Tower. I think that those displays of – civil disobedience are important, but I don't think they create movements. They create political consciousness, which is different.
But that creates movements.
It can. But we're not there yet. And I think the danger of the Indivisible movement is that it doesn't have an ideology other than we have to get rid of Trump. And that's why the Democratic politicians, such as Schumer or Cory Booker, run to those events as fast as they can. Because the Democratic strategy, and we have seen this with the appointment of Schumer, who is the bagman for the Democratic Party on Wall Street, or with the debate over the future DNC chair, they've not addressed the issues that Bernie Sanders did address, including getting money out of politics. We just watched Betsy DeVos, utterly incompetent and a fervent supporter of the Christian right, who has said that she wants to use vouchers to expand the kingdom, in essence use federal money to fund Christian right schools, bought her cabinet seat. And there's no other way to put it. And the Democratic Party is not addressing that issue, nor the issue in any real way of neoliberalism. Trump obviously is a con artist, but he raised the issue of NAFTA and the TPP and the exportation of jobs. And so I think that in the 1960s, in order to get, like with the March on Washington, hundreds of thousands of people there, you couldn't do it because we didn't have the forms of instant electronic communication that we have now. It took months and months and months. So you needed a movement to create that demonstration of power. Now we can create the demonstration of power, but underneath it, it has no superstructure. So my support of, for instance, the march, which I did support, obviously, the day after the inauguration, is that it is a process of building political consciousness, which is good, and networking, bringing people together. But it's not a movement. And we have to regain the kind of militancy of the radical movements, whether at the end of the 19th century or even in the 1930s, to confront on a sustained basis, on a broad front. And part of the problem is that because Trump is reconfiguring the society on so many different levels, whether it's Standing Rock or threatening to put tanks into Chicago, and as Kali points out, I quote him in my article, what happens if you're a black activist in Chicago and they're building the DAPL pipeline at Standing Rock, and you have to confront the kind of physical armed occupation of the south side of Chicago, you fracture the left. You fracture it, and that weakens it. And then we have the whole specter of the Black Bloc, which I have taken on before, in Berkeley. And that is a gift to them, and they used it. I mean, what was the immediate knee-jerk response was, should we even give federal funds to universities? And that assault against those primarily three institutions, the courts, the press, and the universities, are the last thin line. Because if courts are discredited, court rulings are discredited, the press is already has an approval rating as abysmal as the U.S. Congress, then facts become opinions. Then you believe whatever you want to believe. There's a kind of diabolical brilliance in a way to what they are doing. And it is the standard playbook of any dictatorship.
So, I mean, a couple of things. I mean, there's also the sustained militancy of the civil rights movement from 1954 to the mid-60s. That was a clear example of what a consistent militant movement can do. And I think that as kind of a...
Well, yeah, but Mark, that was a five-year problem. But Rosa Parks didn't give up her seat on the bus in 54, and the Freedom Rides were 61.
Exactly.
But it was 5 years. We don't have 5 years.
Well, some people think... we may have five. We don't know what we have, right? But we know. But we
do in this sense, because we know that the institutions that made, as Karl Popper says, incremental and piecemeal reform possible within a capitalist democracy were much more robust than they are now.
Right, but in terms of timing, I mean, if you actually think that there's not time to build a movement and a militant movement in this country that crosses these lines and somehow brings us together across a racial divide, which is one of the things that is also separating us in our movements in this country. If we don't have the time, then we have nothing. I mean,
We don't know if we have the time. I'm only saying that we have a lot less time than we think, and that's why we have to move with a sense of urgency.
But who is the we?
All of us who care about an open society.
So, you know, and when you look at what happens, whether it happened here with Freddie Gray when he was murdered by the police here in Baltimore, or where it happened in other cities, and young people came out, young black folks for the most part leading it, coming out, and it ended up in a rebellion, that's not a nonviolent movement, but there's a lot of rage among a lot of young people, as there were in my generation when I was young. There was a lot of rage. There's a lot of rage in poor communities in this country over the oppression they face every day by police, which is, I think, only going to get worse given this Trump administration. So,
Mark, there is a lot of rage, and we've militarized our police forces and created a system of mass incarceration. So that, and not only that, but we've created in impoverished communities many police states where people don't have any rights. They don't ever get a fair trial. Police can kill with impunity. They've largely already been stripped of their rights, which makes their defiance even more courageous. But what we have done is create zones within the United States, primarily occupied by poor people of color, where they already live in authoritarian, brutal authoritarian conditions. And this is something Hannah Arendt writes about in Origins of Totalitarianism. She herself stripped of her German passport, becomes stateless. And she said, once you create sections of any population which are stripped of their rights, then rights become privileges, which can be taken away. And she said that not only do rights themselves become privileges, but you have physically built, both legally and in terms of forces of control and coercion, i.e. the police and others, a mechanism so that should that unrest spread to the wider population, it's instantly available for everyone else. And that's what we've done. So, look, all of these rebellions, that is our only hope. But I think we also have to recognize that, you know, and this is I don't kind of share America's mania for hope. We have to recognize where we are, and we have to recognize the weakness of both the institutions and the movements that, as Howard Zinn amply pointed out in the People's History of the United States, were the forces that, in essence, opened up and made American democracy possible.
So you conclude the article you wrote, and which I found really interesting. But you conclude by saying, it being the movement has to reject Democratic Party's attempt to ride anti-Trump sentiment back into power. That the enemy is not Trump or Bannon, but the corporate state. But so, and dismantling corporate power. So, but many people would argue that the only way to stop what is the potential of a 21st century form of fascism arising, because it's not like the 1930s, but arising in the United States under Trump and his minions, with all the Koch money and everybody behind him with these very repressive ideas that they're going to try to put into power, is by having a coalition that's broad enough to encompass everybody, or it won't stop it.
Well, but the Democratic Party establishment, I mean, the Democratic Party is not a party in a real sense. It's not driven from a base, the base. The campaign of Sanders, without all the dark corporate money that funded Clinton, without the rules imposed by the Democratic National Committee that prohibited independents from voting in many primaries, without the Democratic establishment that stole caucuses such as Nevada, she wouldn't have had a chance. And the Democratic establishment, if it spoke to working men and women about universal health care and jobs and taking on Wall Street, and would win landslide. It would win election after election in landslides. But it is as captured by corporate power as every other major institution in the country. And that's what brought us this kind of they are the engine, or they are the force that brought us this Trumpism, this Christian fascism that's now emerging. And we have to build, this was, of course, Ralph Nader's understanding, why I had supported Ralph since 2000. We have to build a movement that actually speaks on behalf of the working class, not on behalf of Goldman Sachs. And you can see from even this election that there is no way to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs in the American political system. And we have to break that, because if we don't end up with Trump, and I had hoped that Clinton would win, although I voted green, I won't vote for Democrat, at least giving us another 4 years to try and build something. But what created Trump and what created this Christianized fascism or proto-fascism is the fact that the Democratic Party and the liberal establishment has lost its credibility because it spoke in this feel-your-pain language of liberalism while thrusting a knife into the back of working men and women and the working poor. And that is the fundamental danger. We have to articulate, as I think Sanders did, or as Ralph did, or as the Green Party has done, another vision. And if people want to join us, that's fine. But the Democratic establishment, I don't think at this point even represents its own base. We saw that Clinton was the second most disliked presidential candidate after Trump since, I guess, polls have been taken. This process of the least worst doesn't work. It paves the way for the worst, and this is what we've ended up with.
Well, we have so much more to talk about. I always appreciate you taking time with us. I hope you'll do it again for a much longer period, and we have more time to talk. Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, columnist for Truth Dig, author of Unspeakable and Wages of Rebellion and more. Chris, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to doing it a lot. We have a lot to talk about, and I have a movement to build, so I appreciate you being with us.
Thank you, Mark.
We have to take a short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Kent State University massacre survivor, Dr. Tom Grace, who wrote a history of that moment in history called Kent State, Death and Dissent in the Long 60s. And on our way to break, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ Baltimore's credit union has been helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ Baltimore Credit Union's banner.